Bush since we met last and some plans for the future. This month, is it happening now, Rose, the training for the clerks?
Yes.
Okay. Pat Johnson from BPS, the director of the lab, was kind enough to hook us up with a young lady who's a forensic scientist who has agreed, and BPS has supported her in this and allowed her to help us. She is starting some training for us on the difference between biological evidence and regular evidence, because we have some serious storage units going on, storage problems going on in Texas. And so we decided it would be really a good idea, since the Code of Criminal Procedure just tells the clerks you've got to do something but doesn't really tell them what, that it would be really nice if they understood the difference between the different kinds of evidence so that proper storage can occur. One of our big issues in the unit is collection, preservation, and storage of evidence. So this is one thing we're doing. And the same young lady, she's going to do three presentations for the clerks, district and county clerks. She is also going to do a presentation for judges. The judges have regional training in January and February. She's going to do the same presentation for judges in those 2 months. And both the defense bar and the prosecutors have agreed to put her into programs that they're going to have in the near future, so that everyone will be trained by the same person with the same information. So hopefully somebody in the courtroom will know that we need to do something with this evidence. So it sounds like a little deal, but it really isn't, because Representative McReynolds did a survey of the clerks, and as you know, one of our members, criminal district judge, who is coming, although he's in the middle of a capital voir dire right now, but he said he was coming this morning, he did a survey of the criminal district judges to find out if they knew what was happening to evidence after trial, and only one judge said he had any idea. At least they were honest and said that. The clerks, those that responded to Representative McReynolds' survey, from those that responded, they're very interested in getting the training. Some of them do have standard procedures that they use within their counties, but most do not. So I think this is a real important step in the right direction. So that's one thing we're working on. Now, I can't remember whether it's the National Academy of Sciences or the Forensic Academy, the one that's coming out with the report.
National.
Yeah. Okay. They're coming out with a report on some criminal justice issues. I understand, and I may be wrong, and Pat may know more, it's going to have some information for us regarding fingerprints, ballistics, and handwriting. That report has been long promised. It's supposed to come out in February or March. Now, the president of that organization at the present time has agreed to speak at a seminar that one of our educational grantees is going to put on here in Austin, and we're hoping to get as many people in the system as possible in there. It'll be held at UT, so we'll have a large space. The court yesterday voted to allow administrative monies to help pay for legislative people to also attend the seminar, so we can get as many people in the system on the same page as possible. But we want to know what this report says and what the impact is going to be on the criminal justice system. And that seminar will occur the 19th and 20th of March here in Austin, and we'll have more information about that. I think that's going to be very important. So K-Law is sponsoring that, paid for by the Court of Criminal Appeals. We are Mr. Madoff made off with everybody's money, as everyone knows, and we got a frantic call. It's pretty humorous to me, because Barishek only calls me when he wants something. So he called me frantically because he was in the process of setting up two pilot programs in Texas to work on these new eyewitness ID procedures. He had Austin lined up, and I believe Houston. And the price tag is pretty hefty. Well, unfortunately, I think the American Juniper Society was going to pay for that. And they lost that funding because Mr. Madoff took their money. So Barry's frantically trying to find money to keep those programs alive. And so we have talked to some people who are going out there to see if they can find some assistance for Barry. So we're trying to do that too. We're also, let's see, Oh, I went to Washington to get, I've given several presentations. We've had a lot of interest in the state of Texas as well as nationally about what we're doing with the unit. And I went to Washington, gave a presentation. Jim was there. While I was in Washington, I met with Michael Bromwich, who we all know was the man who led the hit on the FBI lab and the Houston crime lab. And he has agreed to assist us in drafting a protocol for my wild idea of the traveling DNA thing, which will be an additional check on crime lab liability. And Michael's still very interested in assisting us. And because we got that promise from Michael Bromwich, I presented the prospect of having this traveling DNA, which would work like the health department and knock on the doors of labs. EPS is on board with this. I talked to a group of scientists who run different labs around the state. Art Eisenberg, for example, he's a well-known lab director. And at first, they asked me too many scientific questions that I couldn't answer because I'm just a lawyer. But they're very excited about it. And now there's a proposition that since Sam Houston State has a lab and got a $65 million grant from the state to enlarge their lab, and now they're doing toxicology and a few other things, but they're very interested in the idea of perhaps housing not only the Forensic Science Commission that was established two sessions ago, but also the stationary portion of this lab and assisting us with training the forensic scientists that we need for this program. I had talked to Senator Whitmire some time back about this idea. He was semi-interested. He gets more interested every session, but and unfortunately, I don't know how the legislative process really works. I don't even know how you get an idea over there. Jim was kind enough to work with Rose, and we sent two ideas over there. One was, again, this lab, and one was some other form of eyewitness identification legislation. And, of course, I've met with the chief of staff from Senator Whitmire's office. She said, I have no idea if he'll be interested or not. And the next thing you know, we were getting calls from Ledge Council, and they're apparently drafting some things. I've yet to see what their draft. I've seen a draft of the eyewitness identification bill. It looks very much different than Senator Ellis's bill. Senator Ellis is aware of that. Ours is, you know, a different thing. But we have suggested that perhaps we can have a meeting of the minds with regard to eyewitness identification.
Barbara, may I make a suggestion that you send the copies of that to either Mr. McReynolds or myself?
Absolutely.
Since this project works on two sides of the hall.
Right. But we don't have, and we will, Jerry, as soon as we get it, as soon as we see what the final.
Well, I can go to the finance.
Yeah. Well, I'm meeting with Senator Whitmire tomorrow afternoon, so perhaps he'll have some.
Okay.
But the lab stuff, we haven't seen anything on. But these people that I've seen, Houston City, are very excited about it. They asked me if they could talk to Senator Whitmire about this. I said, certainly. And so there we are. So hopefully some of these ideas that we think are good for the system will come to fruition. We'll see. And I'll certainly not only show you copies when we get them, but to everybody on them.
Well, the process would probably be sped up some if we filed it on our side.
Okay. And Senator Ellis's office called me yesterday. They're a little concerned because he's got a version and Whitmire's version. And so somewhere in the middle we'll have a version, but we'll certainly get that to you as soon as
we
see.
We may end
with
two versions.
Yeah. So those are some of the things that we are working on. I'm going to Florida next week to present some information to the National Institute of Justice and the people they've invited from around the country about what we're doing with the integrity unit. So we're very excited, and we, again, welcome any suggestions, any assistance. I gave a speech in San Antonio the other day, and I had some civil lawyers say, you know, I'm trying really hard to understand what you're talking about, but it sounds really exciting. Is there something that we can do, even though we're civil lawyers? Yes, we could talk to legislators, and we'll draft, we'll give money. Well, okay, trust me, we'll be contacting you. And the same when I went to talk to the Forensic Science Commission, although they asked me a lot of questions I couldn't answer, and I felt like the dumbest person in America when I left there, They did call 2 weeks later. They were very supportive, and they were kind of humorous because they told me they were embarrassed because when I left, they said, you know, this is a really good idea, and it's kind of sad that a lawyer came up with it, not a scientist. So that made me feel pretty good. But they all offered to help us any way they could and said they were very, very interested in assisting us in the collection, preservation, and storage of evidence and helping us with some perhaps property room issues. So I have all their names, and I intend to contact all of them and zap them of every ounce of help that they can possibly give us. So we're working very hard. And again, I want to thank Rose because she works all the time at coordinating all of this stuff, and she does an excellent job. And so if you don't have any questions of me, without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker. I was telling Mr. Bethke this morning that after looking at Richard Leo's vitae, I'm never putting out a vitae ever again because it's 18 pages long. He speaks everywhere in America. He's won all kinds of awards. He is presently an associate professor of law at the University of San Francisco. Rose and I had the pleasure of having dinner with him last night. He's a very charming individual, very intelligent, and we're very lucky to have him today. All of our members got, he's just published a new book on police interrogations and American justice. He's got a lot of publications. And without further ado, we're going to listen to Dr. Leo. Richard.
Thank you for that introduction. Can everybody hear me? I'm going to talk a little bit louder. It's really an honor and privilege to be here. I am very impressed with this Texas Criminal Justice Integrity Unit. I think it's a great idea. Whether it was started by a lawyer or a scientist, in the end, doesn't matter. It's really a fabulous idea. I hope it expands. I hope other states model this. So it's really a privilege to be here. I think this is a great, great group and a great opportunity. I'm both a lawyer and a scientist. I taught for many years at the University of California, Irvine. It's funny, when you were mentioning my CV, I was thinking about my colleague Beth Loftus, and she taught me how to shorten my CV. So I was in a criminology and a psychology department. Now I'm in a law school, so I feel like I'm on both sides of the aisle. But I've been teaching on this subject for a very long time, since 1998, on the phenomenon of wrongful convictions. I'm going to talk today about false confessions. That's the area in which I've done the most research. But like Judge Hervey said last night at dinner, we really do know, at least in a legal sense, the causes of wrongful conviction. It's really time to act and implement reforms that's going to bring down the problem. And so I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I really think this is a great, great forum. Okay, so I'm pretty informal. Whatever stereotype you have in California. So I've tried to put together a very
lengthy.
We have movie star governors, you know, that's our problem. So I've tried to make this a lean PowerPoint presentation, but I invite questions from anybody who it's appropriate to ask questions. Or I'll just keep going. I'm going to try to keep it as brief as I can. I know this group is primarily interested in reforms, and I thought about beginning my talk with reforms, and I just can't do that. So what I want to do as quickly as possible is just set some context about false confessions, and then we can really sink our teeth into the reforms. I think in some ways this is an easier area than some other areas, where reforms are a little bit more complicated. Anyway, so that's what we're going to do here, as soon as I can get this going. Okay, so this is a book that I recently published that Judge Hervey mentioned. This is my life's work, basically. This is everything on interrogation and confession from A to Z. I've got some flyers if anybody wants to get one afterwards. I also published a book last year. Both these books are last year. On a particular case in Norfolk, Virginia, a high-profile case involving four false confessions, having to talk to people about that later. A particularly egregious case that both the Washington Post and the New York Times has editorialized about. But we're here to talk today more generally about false confessions. And I just want to begin by talking about some of the myths of false confessions. And maybe this group, I don't need to talk about these myths. The reason why I want to begin with some context here is because no matter where you go, including Austin, Texas, people just say, why would anybody falsely confess? I wouldn't falsely confess. This just makes no sense. Why would two people falsely confess to killing those four girls 8 years ago unless they did, right? So there are these myths that innocent people don't falsely confess unless they're tortured, unless they're mentally ill. People don't really understand the process or know much about the process of interrogation, so they always individualize it. Why would an individual falsely confess? Why would this individual falsely confess? People don't say, what did police do, or what is it about police interrogation that unintentionally sometimes leads innocent people to falsely confess? There's also belief that if you have a false confession, the criminal justice system will catch it. I think we're getting better at catching it, but the system does not always catch it for reasons that I will mention. And so you've got two problems. One is false confessions. Why do people falsely confess? And then the other problem, and this is where interventions are so important, the belief that they don't lead to wrongful convictions and our ability to prevent them when they occur from leading to wrongful convictions. Okay, so how do we know that false confessions occur? We've got lots of studies. We've documented several hundred of them. I'm going to try to go quickly through some of these slides so we can get to the reform issues. But I want to talk about the four ways you can prove a confession false, because most confessions you can't prove false. And this is what the studies that I have on the previous slide document. Okay? So the first way is you can show a crime never happened. Now this is rare, but the first case up there is an Austin case. Billie Jean Davis confessed to killing his girlfriend in 1990 in Austin, Texas. She showed up alive less than a week later in Tucson, Arizona. The other cases under this are just variations of that. So sometimes you can show a crime did not occur. The second way you can prove a confession false is you can show it was physically impossible. The second example there, Jose Soto Martinez confessed to setting a fire in Laguna Beach, California, near UC Irvine, where I used to live. 400 houses burned down. The only problem was he was in jail in Mexico at the time. The scientific exonerations is the third way. We've heard lots about DNA evidence. I think these are all DNA evidence cases that I've got listed. There are other types of forensic evidence that can prove a confession false. You've probably heard a great deal about that from Barry Scheck and others. And then the fourth and final way you can prove a confession false is if the true perpetrator is caught. Chris Ochoa, of course, is a case from Austin, Texas, and this illustrates this category, right? This Joaquin Marino is the true perpetrator, everyone agreed, the DNA match, which shows that he could have been under this category as well. But these four ways of proving a confession false are not mutually exclusive. Now, I mention this because most confession cases do not involve one of these four categories. When an innocent person falsely confesses, it's totally outside their control whether the crime actually occurred, whether it was physically impossible, whether there's scientific evidence, or even whether the true perpetrator is caught, right? So you can have two people who are equally innocent who both falsely confess, but none of those four categories exist in their case, and you cannot, strictly speaking, prove their confession false. So when you get outside that category of proven false confessions, we look for other things that are characteristics that you find in false confession cases that you can't prove false. What I've got up here is really too many words in this PowerPoint presentation, but the idea is very simple. When somebody is innocent and they confess falsely, they typically don't know the facts of the crime. So they give a narrative, and the narrative is typically full of errors unless they've been educated, and this is going to be important later when we talk about reforms and reporting in particular, unless they are educated about the crime, by the officers, which is an inadvertent practice that sometimes occurs, right? The officers mistakenly assume they're guilty and provide information thinking they already know it, and then the person feeds the information back. Or the crime is high profile, it's public knowledge, some aspects of it are public knowledge, right? Or they've learned information from community gossip or from the media. So absent contamination, what we call contamination by police, or absent pre-existing knowledge, when a person is innocent and they falsely confess, they typically get things wrong. The errors are big and small. They don't know unique crime facts that are not likely guessed by chance. And what you see is a narrative that gets fact after fact after fact wrong. Oftentimes they are corrected in the process of interrogation. You also see in the false confession cases, get this right eventually, you also see in the false confession cases that the physical evidence doesn't match. So the evidence left at the crime scene by the confessor doesn't match, by the perpetrator rather, doesn't match to the confessor. Again, I've got a little bit more on these slides than necessary to make these basic points. So the profile, so to speak, I don't really like that word, of a false confessor is they give a confession that is full of errors, doesn't fit the crime facts, doesn't match physical evidence or medical or other credible evidence, and they don't know things. They can't lead police to new or missing evidence. They can't explain case anomalies. When you get a true confession, it fits. People provide the details, they get things right. There's a kind of fit that you don't get in these false confession cases. Now, this is all very important because confession evidence is very prejudicial. I told you that I tried to put together a lean PowerPoint presentation for this group, and I had a bunch of slides on studies we've done, and I decided simply to settle for Justice Brennan's quote here from Colorado v. Conley, a famous confession case. This is actually, I believe, a quote in dissent, that no other class of evidence is so profoundly prejudicial that once you have a confession, because of the weight people put on them, other aspects of the trial are superfluous. In other words, once there is a confession, everybody tends to assume, and that includes me, right? That everybody. We get our paper in the morning, we read that there's a confession, everybody, Barry Sheck, everybody. Our instinct is to assume guilt, and most of the time we're right. This has implications for how criminal justice officials, in good faith, professionals doing their job responsibly, sometimes make mistakes. Assume that the confession solves the crime and don't investigate it. Assume that the person is guilty and look into only charging them. Juries, oftentimes, assuming a presumption of guilt and ignoring other kinds of evidence that are introduced at trial. When we go back and look at the false confession cases, this is called retrodicting, right? This is what we do in all areas of wrongful conviction. You start with the wrongful conviction saying, gee, how did that happen? And go back in time and try to look at step by step what led to that wrongful conviction. We see that once you introduce a confession, or once a confession is elicited, there is a presumption of guilt throughout the system, from police to prosecutors, sometimes to defense attorneys, right? In the Christopher Ochoa case, when the University of Wisconsin Innocence Project called the attorneys who represented Christopher Ochoa, one of them said, why are you wasting your time? He's guilty, right? There is a presumption of guilt even among defense attorneys in many of these confession cases, and then, of course, juries as well. Okay, so that is meant quickly to lay out the big picture. Some of you are very familiar with the big picture of confessions, the problem, the documented cases, how we prove them false, and the consequences. We'll talk more later in question and answer about that. But I just want to say something quickly, and I'll slow down when we get to reforms. Say something quickly about the process that leads to false confessions. And again, I think this is important to understanding the reforms and what we need to do, or at least talk about and think about in solving this particular problem that sometimes leads to wrongful convictions. Police interrogation is important. It's necessary. Confessions solve a lot of crimes. We want police to do it well, and most of the time they do it well. The confession, false confession cases are exceptions. They are the train wrecks and plane crashes. We can do better. We can prevent them. But they are the exceptions. It all begins here. This is the leading interrogation training manual. This manual represents the Reed method. You can't probably see it. Reed is the second author. It goes back to 1947. There are three things this manual does. It teaches police how to interview. It teaches police how to do behavior analysis. This is going to be important. It teaches police how to interview, and it teaches police how to interrogate. Behavior analysis is the analysis of demeanor and body language. And unfortunately, these manuals, these police manuals, repeat a kind of cultural folk psychology about how guilty people act and how innocent people act. And they teach police to focus on nervousness, on alleged evasiveness, on certain verbal and non-verbal ways of talking in response to questions. They essentially teach police they can be a human lie detector. They also teach police this manual, so interviewing is number one, and then number two is, behavior analysis is number one, interviewing is number two, which is witnesses and victims, and then primarily the manual is about the interrogation and how to get confessions from suspects. Now, in understanding why you get false confessions, which ultimately leads sometimes to wrongful convictions, we have to understand first, why do some innocent people get wrongly convicted? Why do some innocent people get interrogated? I'm ahead of myself. This is what this slide is about. Okay? How is it that a person who did not commit a crime gets into the interrogation room? And the behavior analysis, the analysis of demeanor and body language, what I call up here, what they call behavior symptom analysis, is one such reason, right? That somebody who police think is guilty or looks guilty is presumed to be guilty and then interrogated. Police often talk about a gut feeling or a kind of intuition, a sixth sense that comes from experience. Sixth sense that comes from experience. And then sometimes there's here what I'm calling unspoken profiling, where it's the husband or the wife or the boyfriend or the last person seen with the victim, the usual, the obvious suspect who turns out to be wrong. This may seem like a non-important issue. How does an innocent person get in an interrogation? But in my mind, this may actually be the most important issue in understanding false confessions. I told you that I've been studying and teaching wrongful convictions about wrongful convictions for a long time. And in my opinion, so much of this is a temporal process, right? That you have to understand how these wrongful convictions move in time. And if you can get to them early, you can prevent the snowballing effect. That once you're sitting in a jury trial, it's almost over, right? So if you can select suspects in an interrogation who are only guilty, you're never going to get false confessions leading to wrongful convictions. So if you imagine two police departments, one gets it right 50% of the time, the other gets it right 100% of the time, in a way it doesn't matter how bad the interrogation techniques are for the purpose of reliability or a false confession for the one that gets it right 100% of the time. The last sentence on this email is thoroughly investigate. I'm sorry, this PowerPoint is thoroughly investigate before you interrogate. This is the admonition of the Reed method. They say in the manual that I showed a couple slides ago, thoroughly investigate before you interrogate because you don't want to get an innocent person in the interrogation room. So the first step in understanding a false confession is the innocent person is mistakenly interrogated. Interrogation is not designed for innocent people. Interrogation involves specialized techniques. They're techniques of pressure and persuasion. They're necessary techniques if we want confessions. In the manual, most of them, in my opinion, almost all of them, some are questionable, but almost all of them are legal, right? We allow police legally to use pressure and persuasion and deception to elicit confessions, which are very valuable. But interrogation is based on a presumption of guilt. The idea is you only interrogate, you only subject people to these techniques of pressure and persuasion if they're guilty. So the manual says thoroughly investigate before you interrogate. It also says only interrogate people whom you believe are guilty. So the police officer following the manual, this is common practice, is only supposed to interrogate people after they've come to a conclusion that the person is guilty. So if we can improve that diagnostic ability, we're going to reduce false confessions. Because the person is presumed to be guilty, the goal is to move them from denial to admission using these interrogation techniques. And this is where I really cut the presentation here. Interrogation, so we tend to focus on interrogation when understanding false confessions. Interrogation, the techniques of interrogation really involve two things. This manual is 600 pages, and I'm going to tell you about it in 30 seconds. It involves interrogation. This works well for children, too, if you're parents. Interrogation involves convincing somebody that they're caught. All the evidence is against them. No one is going to believe them. Their fate is sealed. No matter what they say or do, the evidence establishes inevitably, incontrovertibly, their guilt. They will be better off. So we talk about the two steps. One, convincing them they're caught. There's no way out. All the evidence establishes their guilt. And two, this is where the salesman part of interrogation comes in. They will be better off. They will somehow benefit by cooperating and confessing. What I've got listed here are some of the techniques: accusations, attacking denials, confronting a suspect with false evidence, that go to the first of the two steps that I've suggested, convincing a suspect they're caught. Now, the last one here, confronting a suspect with false evidence, again, this is very controversial in some circles. Police are allowed to lie about evidence, right? The law allows police to lie about evidence because the idea is the ends justify the means and innocent people won't falsely confess. In the false confession cases, you see lies about evidence in virtually all of them, but just by itself, that shouldn't lead to a false confession. There's usually a lot more going on. The second step of interrogation, which is really the counterintuitive part, not only the first, convincing a suspect they're caught and the evidence establishes their guilt, but the second is using inducements or appeals to persuade somebody that they're better off by confessing, which is counterintuitive, right? Because we all know, especially the lawyers in the room, that you're never better off by confessing if you take the view, as law professors tend to, that our self-interest is in minimizing punishment, right, and avoiding prison. No charges or the lowest possible charges. You have a Western kind of view of self-interest as opposed to perhaps a more communal view of self-interest. So police, the genius, the mind trick of interrogation is persuading somebody not just that the evidence establishes their guilt, but also that they're better off. And I've got some language on the slide which I will very briefly describe, and this is very relevant, will be relevant later to our discussion about recording. Police will appeal to morality, they will appeal to psychological benefits, they will appeal to doing the right thing. We all want people to do the right thing. We want confessions. Confessions are good, right? We want true confessions. Police will, sometimes that's not enough, though, right? Somebody committed a crime, especially, well, I should say not enough if they're innocent, right? An innocent person, if you tell them, get it off their chest, tell the truth, it's the right thing to do, they're not going to confess. You need to up the pressure. You need to up the pressure often for guilty people, too. And so police will refer to the person's processing in the system. You know, get the person to realize that after they deal with the police, there are going to be prosecutors and judges and juries, and that there are some benefits intrinsic to appearing like you've cooperated, some benefits intrinsic to not denying when eventually your guilt will be proven, some benefits to how a judge and a jury are going to look at somebody who accepts responsibility, shows remorse, and as against somebody who continues to insist in the face of overwhelming evidence that they are innocent. This can shade into implicit or explicit suggestions or offers or promises of more lenient treatment if you confess or be understood that way, or threats of harsher punishment or treatment if you don't confess. And police, so it's almost like there's a continuum from these inducements, from really attempts to persuade a suspect to confess. And as you get further toward the leniency or threat, it becomes questionable. You see this in many of the false confessions, that the person understood they would be better off. They could go home, they would avoid a harsh punishment, they thought they would get immunity. Oftentimes, these methods of persuasion during interrogation are delivered through scenarios. Scenarios are called in police language themes, essentially the way it works is that you take a particular crime, like homicide, and you have a good scenario, a bad scenario, and the interrogator tries to persuade the suspect that they can frame and mitigate their culpability if they accept the good scenario, but if they don't, inevitably the bad scenario for them is what will happen. So in a case like like murder case, it might suggest, you know, people are going to think this is a first-degree premeditated intentional murder. They may not say all those words, but at different points in the interrogation, and many murder interrogations go a long time, particularly the ones that involve false confessions, that will be suggested. Planned, serial killer, intentional, premeditated. This is the worst outcome. But we think it was self-defense, or that it was an accident, or that you were provoked, and we would have done the same thing. These two scenarios, premeditated, first degree, serial killer, intentional, the bad scenario, the good scenario, accident, defense, self-defense, provocation, communicate different expectations about what will occur, right? If it's self-defense, it's not a crime. If it's an accident, you didn't have a malicious intent. You will mitigate your culpability. You're not as blameworthy, if at all. If you were provoked, it's understandable, as against intentional premeditated. So the idea is to persuade a suspect that they'll get the good scenario and avoid the bad scenario, and people will understand their situation more favorably. They will not get punished or get a lower level of punishment if they confess. This is all good and fine, except insofar as these are understood as promises or threats. In other words, there are scenarios which don't communicate promise or threat, but in the false confession cases, we see a lot of promises, implicit or threats, that are over the line. Okay, so in this whirlwind tour, before we get to the reforms, and I'm almost there, it's important not just to understand the interrogation techniques and the logic of interrogation, which I've gone through very quickly, but also to understand that some individuals are more vulnerable to falsely confessing than others. Social psychologists talk about, social psychology tries to understand human behavior in social settings. And as a broad axiom of social psychology, the more powerful a social situation is, the longer it lasts, the more compelling, high pressure, the less individual personality matters in explaining behavior. And the weaker a social situation or a social environment, the briefer, the less compelling or high pressure, the more personality matters in explaining behavior. Although we're all oriented to understanding things in terms of personality. Interrogations that lead to false confessions, the prevailing belief among those who study it is that the interrogation, coercive interrogation, is the primary cause of false confessions, and individual personality is second. But there are some individuals who are far more vulnerable to coercive or non-coercive interrogation. Juveniles, people who are young, particularly 15 and under, or under 15, for a whole set of reasons we could talk about later if you're interested. People who are mentally retarded or cognitively impaired, low IQs, low functioning, again, for a whole set of psychological reasons we could talk about. Anybody has mentally retarded people in your extended family or knows of them, you know why. The mentally ill, for perhaps more obvious reasons. And then people who have highly suggestible or compliant personalities, people who have certain personality traits like poor memory or high levels of anxiety are just more susceptible to being led to falsely confessing or falsely agreeing that they committed a crime or did something when in fact they did not. Now, most false confessions are from mentally normal individuals. These groups, these types of individuals are more vulnerable and they're disproportionately represented in the universe of false confession cases that have been documented that I began my talk just mentioning some of the studies about. But still, most false confessions, i.e. more than 50% of false confessions are from mentally normal people, not from people in these categories. Chris Ochoa here in Austin, Texas is not in any of those categories, right? He's a very smart guy. He went on to get a law degree at the University of Wisconsin. So I just want to make the point very clearly that false confession is not a problem of personality. Personality may have a lot to do with it in some cases, but it's not a problem of personality primarily. Okay, so I thought I was at the reforms, but I'm not. Just very quickly, and then we'll get to reforms, and I'll slow down, and we'll talk about changing the world. There are three types of false confession. This can be important, too. The voluntary false confession is the kind of thing that we think about often, a high-profile case, and wackos call into the police and say they did the crime. Lindbergh kidnapping, Black Dahlia, O.J. Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey are all examples of dozens of people calling and saying they committed the crime. You'll remember recently the JonBenet Ramsey case. Michael Carr, I think was his name, right? He called in, everyone thought he did it, got lots of media coverage, turns out he didn't do it. These are not the kinds of false confessions that I study, and these are because they're not related to police interrogation, and I don't think these are the most important in terms of public policy because the police screen most of these out, right? Because the people who call in and say they did this or show up at police departments are so obviously not guilty that these don't get to prosecutors. There's two other types of false confessions. Real quick, one is called compliant. The language doesn't matter so much, but this is where somebody knowingly confesses falsely to avoid the stress and coercion of the environment. This is Chris Ochoa. And when I say Chris Ochoa, this is hundreds of other people where they are so overwhelmed by the stress, in Ochoa's case, the threats, the fear, the pressure, that they know they're innocent. But they confess falsely anyway to escape or mitigate the situation. So this is straightforward. The second kind of false confession is more counterintuitive, and this is important. It's particularly important to me here in Austin, Texas, because you have a very high-profile case right now. You've had it for a long time involving the Overshot murders, which I believe every ounce, every bone in my body involves one of these persuaded false confessions. Persuaded false confession is when somebody confesses to a crime that they have been led to believe they committed despite having no memory of committing the crime. The interrogation process produces the false confession, and this is how it works. A suspect is accused, they deny, they're accused, they deny, they're confronted with evidence that's false because there is no evidence against them. We have your fingerprints, we have your DNA, we have the videotape, somebody else who was involved in the crime did it, mentioned you, right? The suspect says, but how can this be? I'm innocent. I didn't do this crime. I have no memory. The detective thinks the person is just lying about having no memory. Well, people commit crimes all the time with no memory. It's easy to block out a memory. The suspect goes for the amnesia explanation. This occurs usually over many hours of interrogation. And the suspect, because they don't know police can lie about evidence, because they believe the police are telling the truth about the evidence, because they think that they must have done it despite having no memory because there's an explanation provided to them, they come to believe, and I know this just sounds crazy, but there are a lot of cases, documented cases, DNA cases, where this has happened. The suspect comes to believe that the police's representations of what occurred must be right. They must have blocked it out. Oftentimes, people who give these kinds of false confessions have had drug or alcohol problems in the past where they know that you can black out and do something, wake up the next day and be told what you did and have no memory of it. And so it's very persuasive to them, that possibility, that they could have done something in the absence of remembering it. They come to believe, typically after a very lengthy interrogation, that they must have done it. They search for the memory of having done the crime. They can't find it, but they end up constructing a confession narrative where they're often fed the details. They guess and get details wrong. They talk in very hypothetical language, attempted language. I could have done this. I must have done that. I probably did that, because they're guessing or confabulating. Michael Scott, in the yogurt shop murder case, is a perfect example of this. He didn't know the details of the crime. And by the way, Michael Scott's interrogation is public information. His 20 hours of interrogation were played in court. It's a public document. I'm not talking based on any private knowledge. Michael Scott essentially found memories, or thought he was finding memories, when during many, many, many hours of high-pressure interrogation in which he was threatened, he came to believe that he must have raped and murdered the victims in the yogurt shop murder. He gave confession after confession that got details wrong, that didn't fit the crime facts, that we're now learning is disproved by the DNA profiles that have been discovered and tested by both sides. So much of what I said earlier in this talk about the characteristics of a false confession, Michael Scott and Springsteen, Robert Springsteen's confession fit. Springsteen's, in my opinion, is also a false confession, but it's a compliant false confession, like Ochoa's. But Michael Scott is a perfect example of this, the persuaded false confession. In my opinion, there are many cases of proven persuaded false confession, if you don't like the Michael Scott example, but it's important for our following discussion on reforms, we're almost there to understand these different types of false confession. Okay, so I'm going to summarize real quick, and then we're going to get into what to do about the problem, and I'm going to try to wrap things up. This is a different way of describing very briefly everything that I've been talking about up to this point about why false confessions occur and why innocent people get wrongly convicted. Again, I think of everything as a sequential process. What I call here, and I write about this at length in the book, the misclassification error. This is where, always in good faith, police, and it's not always just police, mistakenly attribute guilt or judge somebody who's innocent to be guilty, right? This is where you get an innocent person in the interrogation room. You're never supposed to have an innocent person in the interrogation room, according to police training, right? No one wants an innocent person in an interrogation room. It serves no purpose, right? In the false confession cases leading to wrongful conviction, the first error or mistake is that an innocent person is misjudged to be guilty. Happened in the Ochoa case, happened in many other cases. The second I call the coercion error. I talk very quickly about psychological interrogation and individual vulnerabilities. This is where the innocent person is led to make agree to or make a confession that is ultimately false. But it usually begins with an admission. I did it, or an agreement to a scenario that the person did it. What I call the contamination error, which I haven't really talked about here, is the process where after the person says, I did it, they are educated inadvertently by police, fed the details, and they end up giving a confession that is persuasive. Why do so many people who confess get convicted? Their confessions contain details. They contain details of the crime that are often accurate. They contain vivid descriptions. They contain motives. They look very persuasive. The contamination error refers to that. Sometimes you will hear at trials, and you see this in many of the DNA cases. Barry Scheck, by the way, and his firm have very successfully made a lot of money litigating these cases after DNA proves somebody guilty. And here's how it goes on the contamination error. He and Peter Newcomb have just been brilliant as lawyers. The the prosecutor argues to the jury, this person is guilty and we know the confession is true because only they have provided details only a guilty person would know. And appellate courts uphold convictions sometimes, in some of these cases, saying the same thing. It's harmless error, the person provided details that only the true perpetrator would know. Well, then DNA comes along, and the person is proven innocent, and all the details in their confession that were non-public knowledge, unique, not likely guessed by chance, are in the confession. How did they get there? This is where Scheck and Neufeld, brilliant lawyers that they are, take off their criminal hat and do their civil work and have made millions of dollars, arguing that the police kept the facts, they thus fabricated evidence, they thus violated the person's due process right, they are thus entitled to damages and relief under USC 1983. So this is a problem. Pleading false facts, it's an inadvertent process, it makes confessions look persuasive, it's also a problem for municipalities getting sued by Scheck and Neufeld and others after a confession has been proven false through DNA. Okay, so I hope that what I've talked about so far has given some context broadly about the false confession problem, the big picture, why it occurs. What I want to turn to now is just the reforms. So I'm going to slow down a little bit, and then I'm going to wrap this up. But this is, I think, the meat of at least what I understand we're here to talk about today, or I'm here to talk about. I think that police interrogation, I think false confessions is an easy problem to solve. I think Gary Wells and the eyewitness people are brilliant. I sometimes wonder how easy those problems are to solve, although they've done great work and there's great reforms to be implemented. The reason I say I think this is easy is because the simple solution is mandatory electronic recording of interrogations. I believe, and others believe, this will prevent false confessions from occurring in the first place in some number of cases. And then secondly, if you take the attitude that I do, that some number of false confessions are going to be inevitable, an inevitable byproduct of our system of interrogation, which is valuable, which we need, you will prevent false confessions from getting into wrongful convictions. In other words, you've got two issues, preventing false confessions, reducing them, and then more importantly, from the perspective of the criminal justice system, perhaps, making sure the filters work from prosecutor to defense attorney to judge and jury so that when you get false confessions, they don't result in wrongful convictions, leading innocent people to spend many years in prison, ultimately get released, and then sue the municipalities that convicted them or where they were convicted. Okay, so why is it that electronic recording is so important in reducing false confessions? Some of this is obvious, some of it is not. It creates an objective, comprehensive, and reviewable record. One of the problems that you see in interrogation cases, and again, this is not police misconduct. It's just human nature. Police often remember the interrogation differently than suspects. And so you get a swearing contest, what's called a swearing contest. If you have a record of the entire interrogation, you're not going to get a swearing contest. Chances are both sides will misremember things, selectively remember things, but you've got the record there from start to finish. So you're not going to have that swearing contest. What we see in the false confession cases that led to wrongful convictions is juries typically believe the officer's version and disbelieve the suspect. Now, it doesn't really matter who you believe. The point is finding the truth, right? So you create this record that doesn't lie, doesn't have a selective memory, it's not biased in any way, right? It doesn't misremember. It's an objective record there memorializing what occurred in perpetuity. It's reviewable, meaning not only that the jury at the end of the process is reviewing it, but the police officers can review it, and the police managers can review it, and the prosecutor can review it. And the judge and the jury can review it, right? And so all those filters in the system can review the interrogation if there are problems. And there's two potential problems. There's two potential swearing contests. One is, what were the methods of interrogation? Were there promises? Were there threats? Were there lies that were problematic? What could have led this person to falsely confess? And the second is, do they know details of the crime, or were they educated by the officers inadvertently about details of the crime? So you can dissect it. Not only do the different filters of the criminal justice system kick in, police, prosecutors, judges, juries can all review it, but you can dissect it and try to figure out if there was a mistake or some misunderstandings, where did that occur? So it eliminates the swearing contest by creating an objective and reviewable and comprehensive record. Now, police love, where there is reporting, police love reporting. Many years ago in the state of Illinois, I testified before a legislative committee, and the Kankakee Police Department, which at that time had reported interrogations, testified, a member, and said, "We love it, it's great, I'll tell you why in a second." And then the Chicago police, which didn't report, got up there and said, "This is awful, this is going to kill our clearance rate, we're absolutely opposed to this," right? And this is a pattern that is not uncommon. Departments that have never reported are opposed to reporting. Departments that have reported love it. Why do departments that have reported love it? Departments that have reported love it because it's easy, especially in this digital age. It's easy to do, and it protects them from false allegations of violating a suspect's rights. It shows they did the Miranda ritual correctly, they got a proper waiver. It's not just the suspect's signature on a piece of paper. It shows they didn't make any promises, they didn't make any threats. And so if police are doing their job properly, as most police do most of the time, there isn't a problem, and it backs them up. The prosecutors like it because it facilitates plea bargaining. You don't have two-day suppression hearings about what occurred in the hour-and-a-half interrogation. You got them on tape, dead to rights. There's nothing really to argue about. And so police and prosecutors, where it occurs, tend to like reporting. Now, Tom Sullivan, some of you may know of Tom Sullivan, he's the most senior partner at the Chicago law firm General Block. He's a former federal prosecutor of the Northern District in Illinois. He studied over 500 police departments that have voluntarily recorded interrogations. And he reports, and again, he's a former law enforcement guy, conservative, he reports that not a single police department that has tried electronic recording dislikes it. Everyone's positive once they implement it. 10 states now require it by law. Texas is not one of those states. But I think this is the way in the future. I think in the future, everybody is going to, eventually, everybody is going to record.
Richard?
Yeah.
Do you have any studies on what the impact is with mandatory recording on your other aspect of not bringing the wrong person in the first place? And are they really doing more investigation before they come to this point because they have mandatory?
There's no study on that in particular. That would be a great study to do, especially since so many departments don't record, so that you could essentially have a control group. You could study departments that do record and study departments that don't record, and see if there are systematic differences in the quality of investigation prior to and through interrogation.
Well, when you do that study, will you put a note with my name on it?
Yeah, I won't ask for any of Madoff's money. Any money managed by Madoff's.
Richard, the law in the 10 states, I'm assuming it's different in all 10 states to some degree. What are the differences?
Yeah, that's another good question, good point. In the beginning, the laws were set down by courts. So the first state was Alaska, and the second was Minnesota. Okay, so in the subsequent states, most of it's been done through legislative bills. So you're going to get very different rules if it's by court or by the legislature. Now, with more specifically, in response to your question, the differences that you see in states are, some states require it for all felony. Some states only require it for homicides. That's one major difference. Some states, the ones that do it legislatively, which probably is the best way to do it, have exigent circumstances exceptions. You know, they build in language that protect police who are acting in good faith when the tape recorder is malfunctioning, right? So some states will have an exigent circumstances situation where if the tape malfunctions or it's not feasible for whatever reason, the officer will have to present that to the judge, and the confession won't necessarily be excluded. Those are the primary differences that you see. Now, one of the good things about the fact that this is the law in 10 states is that there's, you know, in the beginning, and Illinois was the first case by legislation, and Illinois restricts it only to homicide cases. In the beginning, there was all kinds of disagreements about the language, the proper language, law enforcement pulling in one direction, defense attorney groups pulling in another. And now we've got models, we've got legislative models in many states, Illinois and Wisconsin most prominently perhaps, so that if groups in the future or legislators in the future want to suggest language or bills, they can look to these other states for models.
Do any of the National Legislative Associations have model bills for this?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I don't know the answer to that. I'm guessing the answer is no.
Talk about the expense, Richard, just a moment or two, because so if it's an unfunded mandate or something, we're very rural in parts of this big state and other things.
Yeah,
and
so
the storage of that once it's completed.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And what I listed here on that slide, one of the points is what you're asking about are the typical arguments against or objections to reporting. I'm very concerned about the cost. I testified before a legislative group in Wisconsin. They have it. The night before, I had dinner with a police officer who was very high in the Milwaukee, I believe, police department in terms of training. And he basically said at dinner to me, he said, look, I'm all for this recording stuff, but we're not getting money for it, and we got to take money out of our budget that we would allocate to drunk driving, and speeding arrests, and this and that, and do recording. And this pisses me off, right? This is what he said. So I'm all for this. Recording is great, but what I don't like is that it's a zero-sum game here in Wisconsin. We can't get money for it, other things are suffering. And I'm very sympathetic to that. So my first point would be that if I were in a police department that didn't record, you know, and I would say we need money for this because it's unfair to take that money from other things that law enforcement needs. Now, the second point on expense, though, is that this is not super expensive. I think the main expense for recording is installing, and I appreciate the point about rural departments, smaller departments that don't have as much volume and as much resource. The main expense, I think, is installing the equipment, right? Getting the recording system up and running. Because once you get it up and running, digital tapes are inexpensive, digital storage is inexpensive. And there are models to do this now. There are firms that go across the country and talk about, you know, how to do this, the logistics of installing electronic recording. This gets a little bit away from your question, but it's now voice active. You can do it where it's voice activated, and of course, digital forms of recording and storage, as I mentioned, are inexpensive. So the front end costs are high, the back end costs are low. The reason why I think, and others think as well, that it more than makes up for its expense, although you know, it saves a lot of time. You think about the typical court trial proceeding or pretrial proceedings, you've got a lot of people making a lot of money in that, right? You've got the judge being paid, the prosecutor being paid, the defense attorney being paid, the court reporter being paid. If you have a three-day suppression hearing, that's a lot of money being paid to a lot of people. That if you have a tape and the prosecutor and defense attorney meet and decide there's going to be a plea bargain, there's not going to be a suppression hearing because there's no suppression issue because the whole thing was recorded and law enforcement did it right, A to Z. There's just no issue. You've saved lots and lots of money. Now, that's not money that would come out of a police budget, right? You've saved money that comes, you know, so it's not like the police have seen the savings, but the system has seen the savings, right? So that's why I think recording, to the extent that the prosecutors are right, that it facilitates plea bargains, it streamlines the conviction process for guilty people, most of the people in the criminal justice system, in one form or another, right? It saves all kinds of resources that can then be applied to other things. So recording is really, I think, a win-win in so many ways. Recording is not only about creating a record, but it's about preserving, and it's about preserving the truth. And to the extent we're concerned with the truth, however that falls, you're guilty, you're innocent, doesn't matter. Recording, I think, is the way to go. And logistically, the obstacles are getting easier and easier to overcome. There are some other objections that law enforcement have. I should tell you that oftentimes law enforcement doesn't object. When I testified along with Chris Ochoa to the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice, law enforcement got up there and said, after I testified, after Mr. Ochoa testified, after I believe Jeanette Pop is her name, the mother of the victim in that case, they got up there and said, hey, look, we're not opposed to law enforcement, but we've got some issues. We don't want this shoved down our throat. And then they mentioned, one person mentioned rural San Bernardino and said, you know, sometimes it's just not feasible, and we want a little bit of discretion. We want presumption of, you know, we're doing our job, and if the tape recorder malfunctions, it's not because we're evil and we're trying to convict innocent people. So a lot of law enforcement is in favor of this, especially those departments that have already voluntarily reported. Some people are opposed. Some law enforcement is opposed. But I think the main arguments are easily addressed. And I think that the last argument, there's logistical arguments, and then there's maybe substantive arguments about not letting a jury see what goes on during an interrogation. As I mentioned earlier, interrogation is about pressure and persuasion. And sometimes it involves yelling, sometimes it involves lies, sometimes it goes on a long time. I don't think that's a problem for a jury to see, necessarily. I mean, you can go over the line and have threats and promises that are impermissible, but, you know, interrogators are going to testify on the stand. We're permitted to lie about evidence. We're trained to do it. It's perfectly okay. I think juries care a lot more about truth than about due process, frankly. And I think if a jury sees an interrogation and sees that the officer is acting in good faith and more or less staying within the rules, they're going to want to know, did the person do it or not? I don't think juries are going to say, oh my God, he raised his voice, or he lied and told him there were fingerprints and there were no fingerprints. I don't think you're going to see, and so far the evidence hasn't borne out, that you're going to see a reduction in convictions.
And they see it on television
every
the
48-hour thing. Right. You might get the CSI effect. You know, like, well, I see these all the time on television recording. How come they're not recorded here? Now, I don't know how much longer you want me to talk, and I'm going to really try to wrap this up. But let me just make a point real quick. I think that this is the solution, mandatory electronic reporting. If I had resources to allocate toward this problem, I would put them all in this basket, or almost all in this basket. There are other things that we can do, and we can talk more about them if you want. I just want to flag them, and maybe I should stop. I'm going to flag them and stop, and then we can have a discussion. You could dedicate resources to police training, right, and better understanding of the interrogation process, the three errors that I mentioned, misclassification, coercion, contamination, how to better understand, recognize, prevent false confessions. I taught classes in 2002 and 2003, 8-hour classes to the Broward County Police felony investigators and the Miami Beach felony investigators. You know, you could do better police training. The Reed manual that I put up earlier in the presentation now has a whole chapter on false confessions, things not to do in the interrogation. So that would be one thing you could do. You could talk about changing the law. The law is concerned more with process than with substance in this area. This may be hard. The typical question that a judge deals with in a trial or pretrial suppression is whether the confession was voluntary. Who the hell knows what that means, whether it was voluntary? Oftentimes an attorney will say, you know, this is an unreliable confession, and the judge will say, that's not the issue here. We're dealing with voluntariness. You could change the rules, particularly rules of evidence, where you could apply the rules of evidence in a different way to emphasize reliability. We could talk more about that if you want. Let me tell you about a couple other things. I'm going to give this to Rose, if anybody's interested. I told you that I gave a talk to the Broward County felony investigators in 2001. They had a problem. The Broward County police had a problem. Sheriffs. That DNA had proven the innocence of some people in very high-profile cases 10, 20 years earlier in the Miami... I forget the name of the paper. The Miami Herald did these stories, story after story after story. So they wanted to prevent this from happening again. So they have this policy. It's a six-page policy, the Broward County Sheriff's Office, where they have a post-confession review team. And they basically, if you get a confession from a mentally handicapped person, they assign an internal unit to review the confession to make sure that it's not false. Now you could also do that where all you have is a confession. You could broaden it beyond the mentally handicapped. You could have special protections for vulnerable populations, juveniles, or the mentally handicapped. You could have jury instructions. You could have more liberal use of expert witness testimony. I'll tell you why I don't like jury instructions and why I don't like expert witness testimony as solutions to this problem. Because I told you earlier on that that I've been studying and writing about wrongful convictions for many, many years, and the temporal dimension of time is very important. If you want to prevent wrongful convictions, whether it's eyewitness error, whether it's jailhouse snitches, whether it's false confessions, whatever it is, you want to intervene as early in the process as possible. Once you get to trials and expert witness testimony and jury instructions, you know, the snowball effect has already occurred. So these are other possibilities we can talk about, other possible reforms in addition to electronic recording of interrogation. But I think electronic recording of interrogation is the way to go. And then my final slide really is just some references on things to read if anybody is interested besides the book that I had mentioned earlier. So that's it, as quickly and comprehensively as I can do. Happy to take questions, comments, discussions.
It seems to me, I just want to know if you agree with this, it seems to me if you required recording of interrogations and you required recording of eyewitness identification procedures, that those two steps would significantly cut down the false convictions, just those two things alone.
I would agree. I think if Gary Wells were here, and I don't mean to speak for him, and you've heard from him, he might say, you know, that in the eyewitness context, recording is not as important as double blind, the matching the fillers, the with or without instruction. You know, all the reforms that the eyewitness people were pushing. When they had Janet Reno's ear and they did the DOJ guides, the guidelines, and they did four. Right, he probably told you about this. They did four because they thought, you know, four things they recommended because they thought once you start recommending more than four, policymakers like tune out. They can only focus on four things, right? They did not put recording of eyewitness in those four. They could have, but they didn't. I think if you record eyewitness photo spreads, that's great. That if there's inadvertent bias or influence or suggestion, you'll catch it, right? Okay, in my area, the false confession area, I think this is the most important thing, and you will cut down false confessions and false confessions leading to wrongful convictions. So I agree with your comment.
There are some police departments that have been recording interrogations for a long time. Are there any studies to show that's been effective, I mean, actually studies to show that's been effective in reducing false confession?
No, the there are studies of reporting, electronic reporting, and how police have adapted to it and what they think about it and how it works. But there hasn't been a study per se on recording and false confessions. Now, it would be good to have a study on how specifically recording. See, Judge Hervey had mentioned this. You know, you could have a control group, right? You could study departments that do record and don't record, and how that affects their interrogation and confession practices. And then, if there were false confessions given in some and not others, you could do a statistical analysis to try to infer what the role of recording was in preventing false confessions. That kind of study has not been done. The arguments about preventing false confessions, you know, draw on what we know about recording from the studies that have been done, as well as cases, and I guess just logic. But there hasn't been the kind of specific study that you're talking about.
When you require recording, does it follow from that that police departments will adopt better methods of interrogation?
Well, I think it does, but there's no specific study on this. I think it does because it puts pressure on police to be more professional and to be more transparent. And while I think most police in most parts of the country, you know, are very professional and very transparent, do a good job in their interrogation and investigative practices. When you're on record, we all know this. When you're on record, you know, you behave better, right? So because false confessions are the deviant case, they're not the norm, they're the exception. In those cases, which we believe are comparatively rare, that lead to false confessions, there will be less incentive to threaten, to do an overly lengthy interrogation to overbear the person's will. On the other hand, there are false confession cases where there were recordings and the false confession didn't prevent the conviction. And I mentioned one in Austin, Texas that I thoroughly believe, too, in Austin, Texas, that I believe are false confessions. There are other cases where people have been convicted and then proven innocent. So the recording it's not foolproof. It's not always going to work, but I think it's gonna work in most of the cases.
In the jurisdictions that require recording, do they address, and if so, how do they address, at what point the recording gets switched on during the interrogation?
So the question is about logistics of the recording. There is a concern among law enforcement that if somebody is confessing in the car ride to the police station, it would be horribly unfair, we all agree, to exclude that because it wasn't recorded. So, you know, that's built into the legislation that there can be exceptions for spontaneous confessions in the field. But the belief is that the interrogation at the station, which is where most custodial interrogations occur, should be from start to finish. And so you can have voice activation, turn it on as soon as you enter the interrogation room. But that's when you got to start, you know, before the Miranda warnings. And the departments that voluntarily, that's where they start. And the states where it's required by law. So when you have a custodial interrogation, they walk into the room and the tape is on as the introductions are made. From start to finish, barring any malfunction.
What state, if we were going to look at a particular state, what state do you think has the best law concerning this?
Well, I think the state of Wisconsin has been very thorough. A court opinion made it mandatory in juvenile cases, and then the legislature wrote legislation after that making it mandatory in adult cases. They have a great criminal justice study group in Wisconsin that consists of police chiefs and prosecutors and senators and defense attorneys. They seem to have transcended partisanship and get along just beautifully and have been very thoughtful about the problem, in my opinion. So if there's one state that I would look to, it would be Wisconsin. They're very happy to talk to people from other states. The state of Minnesota has had it the longest. But it's by state Supreme Court decree, essentially. But if I were trying to figure out, some of you have mentioned studies, right? Studies of it actually in the field. If I wanted to know, how does this really work? And what do police think? And how is it affecting attitudes and processing? I would talk to people in Minnesota because they've been doing it for the longest. But if I wanted model legislation, I would start with Wisconsin. And I suspect once phone calls were made, you know, eventually you would hit upon, you know, they say, talk to this person, talk to that person, and here it is. This is the state of the art.
Going back to the concern about rural departments complying with this kind of report, do you feel that audio only for smaller departments is an appropriate way to reap the benefits?
I do. I tend to think that the most important thing is that the entire process is recorded. And I think audio only is fine. I think it's helpful. I don't think it's perfect, but I think it's helpful. Sometimes visual cues are even distracting. You know, when you're watching an interrogation, you spend so much time watching, you're not listening, whereas audio forces you to listen. I know I've heard anecdotally some complaints about audio. You know, like there might be some tapping in the background or something, and then a defense attorney says, you know, there's a phone book on the table, and they were, you know, pounding the table. And so, you know, you don't get the full view, but audio is relatively inexpensive. And if a rural department said that's all we can do, I would say that's excellent. Having full audio recording of custodial interrogations is an excellent improvement and creates the objective reviewable record.
Questions? Richard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think we're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to hear from the...